and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a just-released poll in Michigan, a state that Trump won narrowly, that found 53% of respondents are either very or somewhat worried that Donald Trump has access to the nuclear codes, with 43% believing the president is not mentally stable, while 12% are undecided on the question of his mental fitness. Dr. Alan Francis, a professor emeritus and former chair of psychiatry and behavioral science at Duke University, joins us to discuss his new book, Twilight of American Sanity. A psychiatrist analyzes the age of Trump and the question of whether Trump is mentally ill or is just a horrible, hateful person. He will also offer a broader diagnosis of the sanity of America itself, a society in which Trump was not only considered a plausible candidate, but was elected President of the United States in spite of his manifest flaws and appalling history. Then we'll examine the futility of the U.S. relying on China to solve the nuclear standoff with North Korea in light of the recent provocation of an H-bomb test coinciding with President Xi's opening of the BRICS summit in China and his meeting with Putin that were upstaged by Kim Jong-un's insult and insolence. James Acton, co-director of the Nuclear Policy Program and a senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and author of Abolishing Nuclear Weapons, joins us to discuss what other options exist to avoid an escalating nuclear crisis between the U.S. and North Korea. Then finally, we'll look into what legal remedies are available at the state level to reverse the rescinding of DACA by Trump and Sessions, and speak with Kamal Esaheb, an immigration policy attorney at the National Immigration Law Center. We will discuss the lawsuit filed on Wednesday by 14 states and the District of Columbia against Trump's decision and how a similar argument is at play as there was in overturning Trump's Muslim ban, which was based on evidence from Trump himself, who made racist statements against Muslim, as he has often done, hurling racist insults at Latinos. And joining us now is Dr. Alan Francis, who's a professor emeritus and former chair of psychiatry and behavioral science at Duke University. He is the author of the award-winning international bestseller Saving Normal and the reference work Essentials of Psychiatric Diagnosis. And his latest book just out is Twilight of American Sanity, A Psychiatrist Analyzes the Age of Trump. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Alan Francis.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
And Dr. Francis, I take it the distinction between Donald Trump and the age of Donald Trump is an important one, in as much as while a lot of people are questioning Donald Trump's mental health, one could, as you do in your book, question the mental health of our entire American society, because this is society in which Donald Trump was not only a plausible candidate, he became president of the United States, for God's sake.
I like everything that you said except plausible candidate. I'd say he was more an implausible candidate and a remarkably destructive president. I think not only our worst, but probably the biggest threat to American democracy since the Civil War. Yeah, I started writing this book 2 years before Trump threw his hat in the ring, and was very concerned that the world that we're handing on to our children and grandchildren is likely to be much worse than the one that we received. Then Trump came on the scene and turned all of what I call societal delusions into, he put them all on speed. And everything that was going wrong before is now exponentially worse than I imagined it could be. The good news is that this may hopefully be temporary American insanity, and that Trump could be a gift horse in disguise, that a kind of shock treatment, that by being such a grotesque representative of all of the worst possible policies, hopefully he will serve to discredit them.
Well, I meant to say he was considered a plausible candidate, not that he was a plausible candidate. But I think, though, there's a little preface, surely, to Donald Trump's this anomaly in American politics. It's not entirely an anomaly when you consider that Sarah Palin was a kind of precursor. And my sense is that what happened with Palin and has been compounded with Trump is that there's a change in America away from a sense of meritocracy. And the idea is now, because perhaps people are not that well educated, that people can now vote for people that are just like them, as opposed to people they consider to be more qualified than they are.
Well, there's been a strain in American politics that goes back to the, the age of Jackson, just after the first founding fathers, of a kind of American know-nothingism. Mm-hmm. It's not new. We've had a paranoid strain in our history that has been well described by Richard Hofstadter 40 years ago. And we've lived through McCarthyism. We've lived through the John Birch Society. Yes, we lived through Sarah Palin. I think that what's unique now is that the president of the United States is giving a bully pulpit to all the things that are worst in America. And while we've had fringe movements forever that might be execrable in their pronouncements and their policies, and often enough to take the Ku Klux Klan and their behavior, we've never had a legitimization of the worst angels in American life by the leader of the country. We've turned America into a reality TV show. I think Trump was elected largely because of his skill in attracting attention to his every movement, his every saying, his every tweet. And we've brought out, I guess the Internet has given us the greatest availability of knowledge unimaginable in human history, but hasn't brought with it a similar accumulation of wisdom, and that the best trends and the worst trends can become quickly amplified and travel around the world in seconds. I think it's time for us to see Trump as a mirror on our soul. The reflection back is pretty ugly, but that there's a lot more to America than what he represents. He's a minority president, and his popularity is appropriately shrinking rapidly. I think we have to figure out what went wrong in our society and start curing it.
And again, I'm speaking with Dr. Alan Francis, who is a professor emeritus and former chair of psychiatry and behavioral science at Duke University. He's the author of the award-winning international bestseller Saving Normal and the reference work Essentials of Psychiatric Diagnosis. And his latest book just out is Twilight of American Sanity, A Psychiatrist Analyzes the Age of Trump. So there is something out there in the zeitgeist, though, in terms of questions about Donald Trump's mental health and mental stability. I know your book is also diagnosing the broader issue of America's mental stability to have elected this guy, or at least a minority of Americans to have elected him. But just to touch on Trump himself, a poll was just done in Michigan that finds 53% of Michiganders are worried about Donald Trump's access to the nuclear codes. And they question his authority to launch nuclear weapons with considering questions about his mental state. And it particularly relates to North Korea, or the current tensions over North Korea, where this poll found that the Trump threatening North Korea with fire and fury led to 38% of respondents saying that they are very worried about nuclear war and about Trump's access to the nuclear codes, and 15% said that they were somewhat worried. So there's something happening there. Now, I would have thought that the Democrats weren't so brain dead. It'd be very easy to tie these two things together, that you've got Senator Corker, Republican chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, questioning Trump's stability, which is, I think, implies mental stability. You got this poll in Michigan. This ought to be a real national debate, whether the president of the United States that we have now in the Oval Office is a fit and sober and responsible steward of the nuclear codes, where at his fingertips, Donald Trump has the ability to destroy the world.
Yeah, and what a world it is when you have two idiots like Trump and Kim able to create such mayhem without anyone blocking either one of them. I think that Trump's evil and instability together have the useful purpose of finding the weaknesses, the vulnerabilities in our democracy. It should never have been that one person decided whether we would establish this cataclysmic nuclear war. based on that person's individual preferences and feelings of the moment. It always should have been a much more institutional decision. The Constitution says that we mustn't declare war except with Congress's approval. And that's been honored in the breach in the last 50 years of many undeclared wars. I think what Trump represents is an opportunity to take advantage of his grotesque behavior to build institutional safeguards. Congress has just reconvened. I'd say the first order of business is not a tax cut to the rich. The first order of business should be containing the risks presented by this president. There should be legislation that makes clear that there's a joint decision about starting a nuclear war that's not just in the hands of the president. We don't want one morning to awake and find out that instead of tweeting peevishly, he decided to tell a general to press the button. There should be a clear mandate that the president get approval from Congress before starting a war. That's implicit, but it's been decided in the past. We shouldn't allow that to happen in the future. The solution to Trump's bad behavior is political, and it rests largely in the hands politically of the Congress and of the Supreme Court, and it has been very much the job of the free press to contradict and point out all the lies that daily fill Trump's tweets and his news briefings. So I guess the point I'm making here is that the solution to Trump is political. It's not psychological. It's not saying that he's crazy and therefore we should put in these institutional protections. He's just a bad person, an incompetent person, in way over his head, ignorant, serving his own interests, not the larger interests of the country, of the world, or of future generations. He's absolutely the worst possible choice as president. He's always been like this. There's never been a moment in Trump's life when he hasn't been a spoiled brat. He's immature. We should see him as someone in a perpetual terrible twos. Almost everything he does is wrong and bad, but that doesn't make him mentally ill. We shouldn't confuse bad behavior with mental illness. It's highly insulting to the mentally ill. Most of them are really nice people and don't do bad things. It's highly insulting to them to be lumped with Trump. And it underestimates the evil he can do to assume that this is all craziness. Much of what he does is crazy like a fox.
Well, I'm reminded of Senator John Danforth, former Republican senator and UN representative. He recently made a statement calling upon his fellow Republican senators to save the GOP from this hateful man. So some people are stepping up, even within the Republican ranks. But what you've just suggested, which should be a national priority, and this is the first thing that the House and Senate should be working on, which is putting a barrier between Trump and the nuclear button. There's some comfort taken by the generals around him, but they don't have the authority to stop him. So what you just said is, to my mind, should be a national priority. So why isn't it?
Why is it not?
Yeah, what's the problem here?
I think, the problem is that we have a Congress that is cynical in the extreme and has the wish to ride Trump to things like ridiculous tax cuts for the rich, to destroying Obamacare and the coverage it provided for ordinary people. So we have the combination of 40 years' worth of propaganda to the people, of congressional redistricting and gerrymandering and enormous contributions that have created a Congress that's irresponsible, that's radical in the extreme. Trump is grotesque, but the Congress itself, the Republican Congress, is radical in the extreme. And their cynicism in trying to ride him to their own Coke agenda. I think that the what's happened because Trump is so divisive, a more skillful politician like Pence would have been much more dangerous than Trump is, and could be more dangerous in the long run than Trump is, because he could tie together the most obscenely despicable parts of the Republican base with the more selfish and cynical parts, but less obviously grotesque. What Trump has done is divide the Republican Party into a portion that's really, John Birch, off the wall, non-Republican, absolutely extremist, And that base, which may ultimately be maybe 20 to 30% of the general population and maybe half of the Republican Party, because after the president's strategy, they've actually gone after that base very aggressively. That base is crucial to the Republicans' governing coalition. And if they lose that base, they become a splintered, fragmented party. So I think that they're doing everything possible to postpone the reckoning. And they're choosing politics over patriotism. The loyalty to the party, their power, their donors, the Koch brothers, is more important to most of the hacks in the Republican Congress than actually doing what's right for the country. And the Democrats, as you point out, are weak in victory and absolutely pathetic in defeat. They don't have the skill, the propaganda skills. When you're telling the truth, sometimes it's hard to be good at telling it. But if you know you're lying, you develop the very greatest in public relations propaganda skills to be able to pass off the lie. The Democrats are consistently suggesting the right thing, but suggesting in just the wrong way to capture the public imagination.
Well, so many Democrats and people who are alarmed by Trump are counting on impeachment as opposed to coming up with a narrative. If an election was held today, I think the Republicans would win in the absence of a counter-narrative. But when you talk about Trump, that it's an insult to the mentally ill to refer to Trump as being mentally ill because he's just a bad and horrible person. That seems to be something that's becoming so evident. I'm astounded that people can't connect the dots here. This is a man who has made so many overtures to Nazis, white supremacists, that it's almost impossible not to assume that both he and Jeff Sessions and Stephen Miller are white nationalists. And particularly Sessions' case and Trump's case, they hate Latinos. Trump started his campaign by talking about Latinos as rapists and murderers. He blamed Hillary Clinton's victory in the popular vote, winning by 3 million, on Latino undocumented voters, these mythical people, only in his diseased imagination tipped the scales. And of course, he won the presidency in any case. But, I mean, I could go on, you know, Joe Arpaio running concentration camps and rounding up Latinos like the Gestapo rounded up Jews. I mean, when are we going to start a real dialogue about who this guy really is?
Well, also, he's always been this way. There's nothing new about this. His first entry into real estate was greeted by a federal lawsuit because the buildings he and his father were managing refused to accept black tenants. He's been a racist from the get-go. And the person he hired, his mentor in conspiracy theory, was Roy Cohn, who was the brains behind Joseph McCarthy's witch trials in the 50s. And Roy Cohn made him an expert in attacking your opponent as opposed to defending yourself and making up stories. The idea of fake news goes back to Roy Cohn and McCarthy 60-odd years ago. The things that we see in Trump now that are increasingly disgraceful and hard to imagine have been part and parcel of his entire career. There's nothing new here. The Trump of the campaign is the Trump of the presidency. And what seemed reasonable to some people as reality TV in the process of considering his candidacy should begin to be clearly disastrous to almost all in the president. And I think that his base is, he has a solid core of people, I'm not sure, maybe 20% of the population, who, is, as he put it, would still vote for him even if he shot someone in the middle of the day on Fifth Avenue. So there are some people who are absolutely wedded to the Trump brand no matter what. His TV fans, the white racists, the anti-Semites, the Nazis, he will have a solid core of people that will go down with the ship. But I think a lot of people will have second guesses about Trump and begin to have buyer's remorse about having made a terrible mistake. I think that patriots love their country have to worry about a president who prefers Putin to his own national intelligence agencies. I think people who are losing their medical coverage are going to be beginning to wonder whether he really represented them in the election. I think the little guy who's economically disfavored by the inequality, I've seen that inequality in America, is not going to be too happy about the tax cuts that Trump will the giveaways he'll be giving to the super rich and to the corporations. And I think that anyone who doesn't like Nazis and realizes we fought a war to stop Nazism is not going to be too happy about a president who seems to endorse them, the white supremacists and the anti-Semites. And finally, most puzzling, it's hard for me to understand anyone who's truly religious supporting Donald Trump. The Jesus and Donald Trump are diametric opposites. Jesus was someone who always preached for the poor and defended them against the depredations of the rich. The rich would have trouble getting into heaven as much as a camel getting through the eye of a needle. Kicked the moneylenders out of the temple. He would not be voting for Donald Trump. Jesus lived in the Roman Empire that had lots of abortion and gay love that was very prominent, and never once in the New Testament ever said a thing about gay love or abortion. He constantly spoke about religious hypocrites, and it was unforgiving about them. I don't think that the evangelical leaders who sold their souls to devilish Trump, I don't think they represent real Christianity. I'm hopeful that increasingly their followers will come to realize that Trump is a false prophet. So my guess is that we're going to see a gradual but steady desertion of Trump's base, and before very long, he's going to be very much alone. I'm afraid he may be impeached. I think that, you know, you don't burn your bridges, and he certainly has been incredibly insulting towards the two people who would most determine whether he's impeached or not, McConnell in the Senate and Ryan in the House. I think that he's taken every person who might have helped him towards a saner administration. He's consistently wound up betraying their loyalty and blaming them for his problems. And my guess is it's going to be like King Richard, you know, my kingdom for a horse, that at some point Donald Trump will be so isolated that the Republican Party will see it in their cynical best interest to get rid of him rather than to continue to try to hold together what's essentially an untenable coalition. And I'm actually not pleased by that. I mean, I'd rather have, so long as there's no nuclear war and no impulsive international disaster, I'd rather have Trump be the grotesque face of the Koch brothers' Tea Party policies than smoother people like Pence and Ryan who could sell a bill of goods much more successfully.
Well, just in closing, you mentioned that Trump is way out of his depth, which is clearly the case. And I see him as a very frightened man who is deeply incompetent. Somewhere in his dark soul, he knows that he's not up for the job, and he lashes out all the time, and he pretends, and he has these sort of photo opportunities and all this bluster and nonsense and these pathetic stunts, as opposed to governing, that he becomes a serial activity of his. And he watches all the time his reviews, he watches TV. He doesn't. It's like an actor who doesn't. It's not interested in the performance, but only interested in the reviews. It's a very strange situation. But as he gets more isolated and delusional, he's just lost apparently his emotional anchor. This Keith Schiller, former personal bodyguard turned director of the Oval Office operations, who could wander in and out of the Oval Office at will. Many people see him as his closest confidant, perhaps Trump's only friend. So with the loss of Schiller, if indeed Schiller was his emotional anchor, and General Kelly trying to bring some discipline, and most analysts think that there'll be an explosion between Trump and Kelly, who Trump can't stand already, and there might even be some kind of a meltdown because he won't have this kind of bodyguard thug friend around to whisper in his ear like Rasputin, that Trump himself might have a meltdown.
It's certainly possible. I think, first of all, let's not call him delusional. To be delusional, you have to have a fixed false belief that can't be contradicted by obvious reality, and it has to be personal. Trump's a conspiracy theorist, but he has been his whole life, and so are almost half of Americans. If 35% of the people believe your conspiracy theory, you're no longer delusional. So he's dangerous. As a conspiracy theorist, he's divorced from reality in many issues. That doesn't make him mentally ill. Yeah, I think that it's perfectly conceivable that he can come apart at the seams under the stress of the real burdens of the office and the man-made incompetence in his exercise of it. And we don't know that we've seen the worst of him. That's why I think that before we see more troubles, we have to create political institutions to protect us from his worst depredations. But I don't think it helps to psychoanalyze him and to worry so much about his motivations. I think he is one of the most transparent people who ever lived. His psychology is not very interesting because it's so obvious. I think the goal is to figure out systematic ways of protecting the nation from Donald Trump. And this will be much better done by a deliberation in Congress than it will be done by a bunch of psychologists giving him name-calling that he has this diagnosis or that diagnosis. So we shouldn't let the interest in Trump's personality, the kind of reality show of what did he say next, what will he do next, the distraction that comes from all of us glued to the screen to see what outrageous last act. We have to not focus so much on that, but assume the worst for the future, that there's nothing stupid that Trump can't do, and we have to figure out ways of protecting against his impulses.
Well, Dr. Alan Francis, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Well, thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Dr. Alan Francis, who is a professor emeritus and former chair of psychiatry and behavioral science at Duke University. He's the author of the award-winning international bestseller Saving Normal and the reference work Essentials of Psychiatric Diagnosis. And his latest book just out is Twilight of American Sanity, A Psychiatrist Analyzes the Age of Trump. We're going to take a brief station break and back, examining the futility of the U.S. relying on China to solve the nuclear standoff with North Korea. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is James Acton, who's the co-director of the Nuclear Policy Program and a senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He's a former member of the Nuclear Security Working Group and was co-chair of the Next Generation Working Group on U.S.-Russia Arms Control. And he recently published a Carnegie report, Wagging the Plutonium Dog, Japanese Domestic Politics and Its International Security Implications, and is the author of Deterrence During Disarmament, Deep Nuclear Reductions and International Security, and Abolishing Nuclear Weapons and Why Fukushima Was Preventable. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Acton.
It's good to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, just to touch on wagging the plutonium dog, in terms of Japan is a country that a lot of analysts say could go nuclear very quickly. They've got vast amounts of plutonium. Surely this is something that China must be concerned about, with Kim Jong-un's nuclear weapons program operating at warp speed. Is that the idea that North Korea will have more dependence upon the United States and its nuclear umbrella, and that at some point or other Japan could consider going nuclear? Surely that is a problem for China, is it not?
Well, it certainly would be a problem for China. I mean, let me say first of all, I worry much more about South Korea developing its own nuclear weapons than Japan doing so. I think for a range of reasons, including Japan's history and the fact that it's the only country that's ever been attacked with nuclear weapons, I think Japan is still a very long way from having a serious conversation about developing nuclear weapons. I don't think South Korea is all that close either, but I worry much more about South Korea. From China's perspective, China, I think, feels it's caught between a rock and a hard place. It certainly worries enormously about North Korea's nuclear program. It worries about the possibility of of South Korea and Japan turning nuclear, going nuclear. It worries about the U.S. Deploying military assets in the region to deal with North Korea. At the same time, China also worries that if it puts so much pressure on the North Korean regime that the government collapsed, it worries about what would happen afterwards. In particular, I think it worries about Korea being reunified on South Korean terms and having U.S. troops all the way up the Korean Peninsula. So we would certainly like to see China put more pressure on North Korea. But from the Chinese perspective, it's as I say, I think China feels it's caught between a rock and a hard place at the moment on North Korea.
Well, it seems that we're being somewhat delusional in thinking that China is the key to this. Donald Trump certainly felt that way after he met with Xi Jinping. I mean, a couple of obvious caveats here. One of the first people that Kim Jong-un killed was his uncle, who was the liaison between North Korea and China and the Chinese government. And then he killed his older half-brother with sarin gas in Malaysia because he was under Chinese protection and might well have been somebody that Chinese might have engineered a coup to put him in so that the Kim dynasty could continue, but on a friendlier basis. So it seems to me that we are wasting our time. And you just pointed out China being a rock and a hard place, that all the talk of putting more pressure on and cutting off gasoline and oil, which would many people think would bring about a collapse, is not what the Chinese want. So where is the middle ground? Where is the wiggle room here?
Well, look, let me make two general points about China. Firstly, it's certainly true that China has more leverage over North Korea than any other country. It's also true that China's not going to solve our North Korea problem for us. And that there is a limit to how much of that leverage the Chinese are willing to use. My belief about what to do about North Korea is that there are no good options at this point, but there are certainly some options that are worse than others. North Korea, I think in practical terms, we have to accept that North Korea is going to have nuclear weapons for the time being. I don't advocate recognizing North Korea as a nuclear-armed state. I think we should still maintain denuclearization as a long-term goal. But in practical terms, there's nothing much we can do in the short term to advance the goal of denuclearization. What I would like to see us focus on is more of a risk reduction agenda. So to give kind of one concrete example, and this is something that I think the Chinese could help broker, North Korea has threatened to fire missiles in the vicinity of Guam. That would be an enormously provocative and dangerous action. And I think that threat has not been taken off the table. So I would like to try and reach a compromise with the North Koreans by which they agreed to no missile test flight overflying Japan or South Korea, which would prevent them from firing missiles in the vicinity of Guam. In return for us agreeing to no training flights of bombers within a specified distance of North Korea. I think that kind of agreement would help de-escalate the current crisis that we're still in and also prevent the occurrence of future crises. I think it's the kind of deal that the Chinese conceivably could help broker. I don't know there is any interest in North Korea for this kind of deal. I don't know right now there's any interest in the U.S. or China for this kind of deal. But I think that seems to me the least bad of a number of not terribly good options right now.
Well, but in terms of the continuing focus on China and the expectation that somehow China's going to get our irons out of the fire, why aren't we focusing on Pakistan and Iran? There's obviously been a greater Pakistani role in helping with Kim's nuclear development and particularly missile technology, and apparently Iran also plays a covert role. And we know about the rocket motors coming from Ukraine.
I think it's almost... And the story that the North Korean rocket motors came from Ukraine, I think is almost certainly incorrect. And there has been a lot of intelligence community pushback on that. You will find a lot of occasions of unnamed intelligence officials saying they think that's wrong. It may be the case that some ideas, you know, some of the theoretical ideas about how to build those engines did come from Ukraine. But the actual motors themselves were almost certainly manufactured in North Korea. And similarly, Pakistan did provide help to North Korea, both with missile technology and with, more importantly, enrichment technology. I think that help has largely dried up now. I think the North Koreans there are self-sufficient. And the exact extent of Iranian-North Korean cooperation on nuclear technology is very, very unclear to me. It's not clear to me there's very much on that front at all. The reality is that I think the North Koreans are very largely self-sufficient in technology at this point. And we're not going to be able to significantly constrain the program by cutting off external sources of technology just because they don't rely on them very much anymore. As I say, I think China could play a role in helping put pressure on North Korea, but I think it's not going to put the kind of pressure on that denuclearization requires. I think there is a there is a practical risk reduction agenda that the Chinese may be willing to help us with.
So is it possible that our attitudes were somewhat clouded by a kind of a racist notion that these people aren't technically capable of doing what they're doing? And if, as you say, they've managed to do this mostly on their own, my understanding is that the nuclear tests that they've had starting about, 11 years ago, particularly the small yield tests, have always been developing efficient trigger, that this has always been their program, was to go thermonuclear, which is their current claim. I don't know whether now that these tunnels have collapsed, whether the overheads have picked up anything, but what's your understanding about the previous tests? They all look like low-yield fission trigger mm-hmm. tests.
There's a couple of thoughts. Firstly, I didn't claim the North Koreans did it all on their own. I think North Korea got a lot of help, especially early in its program. I think it doesn't need that help any longer, and it's increasingly indigenized the program. In terms of the nature, the purpose of the earlier tests, it's very, very hard to tell. I mean, we just don't know what they were testing earlier on. If you forced me to guess, so firstly, I believe it is very likely that the North Koreans did indeed test a thermonuclear device over the week last weekend. I don't know that for absolute certainty, but for a variety of reasons, I think it is likely they have now tested successfully a thermonuclear weapon. My guess would be that what they did in terms of their nuclear development program is broadly the same to what everyone else has done. Their very earliest tests, I suspect, were fairly simple fission devices that were just designed to see if they worked. Subsequent tests, I think, probably were trying to design lightweight fission devices both to mount on warheads and to be triggers for thermonuclear weapons. They took 6 tests to get their first thermonuclear shot. The Soviet Union, for instance, did it in 4 or 5. I forget the exact number. I mean, generally speaking, it just hasn't taken countries lots and lots of testing to get to their first thermonuclear device. So North Korea took a long time in one sense because it hasn't tested very often, measured in terms of the number. I mean, it's still tested far too often, but I mean, it hasn't tested at the same rate that other countries have historically. But the number of tests it needed is kind of right in line with what we would expect based on historical comparisons.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, what do you think is the utility then of all of this pressure on China and the expectation that China should do something? Vladimir Putin at the BRICS meeting in China was pretty contemptuous of that idea, and he said that they'd eat grass before they give up their nuclear weapons, which I think is pretty much what Ali Bhutto said in Pakistan.
It was exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
So Putin, I mean, is it possible that Putin could come across as the kind of peacemaker here, as the sober steward of his nuclear arsenal, particularly when a lot of people are questioning our own president's mental state, let alone his access to nuclear weapons? I mean, that is something that you keep hearing from South Korea, too, where the man in the street is equating crazy Kim with crazy Donald Trump. I mean, that's not a good situation.
Well, look, as I've already said, I think that as much as denuclearization should remain the long-term goal, I don't believe it is a plausible short-term goal. I think it is right that the Kim regime views nuclear weapons as being absolutely integral to its survival, and there's nothing we can do in the short term to induce them to give it up. And so there is a real question about if we successfully put pressure on North Korea, what do we want to use that pressure for? What's our ask? What do we want them to do? you know, the whole point of building up pressure is that if they then do something that you want them to do, you take that pressure off. I think if our goal is denuclearization, then we're going to fail. Then we will just keep on ramping up pressure and they will keep on advancing the arsenal. The real question for me is kind of, are there interim steps that we can ease, you know, that we can get them to do to slow down the program? And right now, nobody is, the Russians and Chinese aren't thinking along those lines. I mean, the Russian and Chinese are thinking, you know, in terms of what, you know, trying to, their current favored proposal is the so-called freeze-for-freeze proposal, in which North Korea freezes its programs in return for a freeze in U.S. military exercises in the region. That's not a proposal that I would support. I think we need a lot more creative thinking about what the interim steps we can take are to try to de-escalate this very dangerous situation.
Well, just in closing, I don't know whether you noticed the op-ed in today's New York Times, the way to make North Korea back down, from Sung-Yoon Lee, who I've spoken to a number of times, suggesting that you could choke them off economically. You don't have to necessarily starve the people of North Korea, who are starving in any case, or cut off their oil, but you can wage financial war against the regime. Is that a viable, plausible strategy?
Well, as I say, I think there is no doubt that if China were willing, one could significantly increase the economic pressure on North Korea. I still think it is fundamentally unlikely that North Korea is ever going to give up its nuclear weapons. The value of increased economic... There seems to be two reasons why it's worth increasing economic pressure on North Korea. First of all is to send a very clear message to other potential proliferators that you will incur massive costs if you go down that route. I think that is a legitimate reason for upping the pressure on North Korea. Secondly, as I've said already, I don't believe that we can realistically force North Korea to denuclearize by pressure. Is it possible that pressure may, say, lead the North Koreans to agree to a moratorium on nuclear testing? Possibly. There is certainly, you know, an economic price that I would be willing to pay. You know, there are certainly sanctions that I would take away if they agreed to that kind of arrangement. So that seems to me the value in the North Korean situation of trying to up the pressure on them is if we're willing to accept half measures that nonetheless make us safer.
Well, James Acton, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me.
And again, I'll be speaking with James Acton, who's co-director of the Nuclear Policy Program and a senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He's a former member of the Nuclear Security Working Group and was co-chair of the Next Generation Working Group on U.S.-Russia Arms Control. And he recently published a Carnegie report, Wagging the Plutonium Dog, Japanese Domestic Politics and Its International Security Implications, and is the author of Deterrence During Disarmament, Deep Nuclear Reductions and International Security, and Abolishing Nuclear Weapons, and Why Fukushima Was Preventable. We can take a brief station break. We'll be back discussing the lawsuit filed on Wednesday by 14 states in the District of Columbia against Trump's rescinding of DACA.
To send someone away, got my back covered. Said, how you been all led astray? Come, let's count, it's absurd. They lead you to the race where no one's asked them to.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Kamal Esaheb, who is an immigration policy attorney at the National Immigration Law Center, who engages in advocacy and technical assistance relating to state and local enforcement of immigration law and access to legal status for immigrants. His advocacy has focused on passage of the DREAM Act, implementation of the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals Program, and state and local enforcement of immigration law. Welcome to Background Briefing, Kamal Esaheb.
Thank you for having me.
And at this point, there's a lot of anger and pain and protest across the country. The only place where I see any celebration is at Breitbart, where they're celebrating a major policy win. And, of course, Jeff Sessions made the announcement, not Donald Trump. And one of the extraordinary things that, in fact, I saw it on Rachel Maddow's program on MSNBC, where she did some historical background on immigration policy going back to the 1920s, when the immigration policy in this country was set by a couple of prominent advocates of eugenics. And it's extraordinary then, and then they played an interview that Jeff Sessions did on Breitbart, being interviewed by no less than Stephen Bannon back in 2015, where Jeff Sessions, then Senator Jeff Sessions, said that he sees the immigration policy that he would prefer modeled on the 1924 law, which again was put together by these eugenics proponents who wanted to have just a white country and celebrated whiteness. So can we make a case that there's some racism going on here, not just with Sessions and Stephen Bannon and Stephen Miller, but also the president himself, who started his campaign calling Mexicans racists and murderers, blamed Hillary Clinton's 3 million victory in the popular vote on Latino illegal immigrants voting, insulted a judge who he called a Mexican, who was in fact born in Indiana, and I could go on. So at what point are we going to have an honest debate about this? Because it does seem to me that racism has played an enormous role in this current situation with DACA.
Yeah, well, to us it's clear that when you look at what this president has said and what he has done, you know, whether it's keeping people from coming into this country based on their faith or putting a wall between our country and our neighbors to the south, you know, who are Latino, or when it comes to taking immigrants who are here, DACA recipients or others who are undocumented and who are, you know, predominantly from Latin and from South and Central America, but also from places in the world like Asia and Africa, and saying you're going to try to deport them all, you're going to hire an army, a deportation army, to deport them all. I mean, it's clear to us that, you know, that is fundamentally driven by an idea of keeping America, white, making America white again, you know, of as one of the folks who is a leader of some of the anti-immigrant organizations, John Tanton has advocated for, keeping America a European American, majority country. And so for us, I think that at its root, all these policies of rounding up brown people, of taking dreamers and telling them that they need to make their travel plans, of putting a wall between our country and our neighbor to the south, of saying you can't come to the U.S. based on how you pray. I mean, to us, all of those things are fundamentally rooted in, you know, this idea of trying to keep America looking a certain way.
Well, Republican Congressman Steve King of Iowa said about the rescinding of DACA, they came here to live in the shadows, and we're not denying them that opportunity to live in the shadows. So that's sort of laying insult on top of cruelty, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. No, absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, let's talk a little bit then about what's happening at some of the states are filing suit. Is there a legal remedy to undo? Because the legal excuses given, the fig leaf that Sessions has offered, and actually Sessions not just offered a fig leaf, and so did Trump, about the state attorney general's, largely the attorney general of Texas, driving this. But Sessions, in his statement announcing the rescinding of DACA, also conflated these DACA recipients with criminals and terrorists, which is the opposite of what the truth is. In fact, they've proven to be the model immigrants that Senator Cotton, when he recently trotted out his idea for a new immigration policy, the DACA recipients would fit into that kind of model. So a lot of lies and a very flimsy legal fig leaf. So what is the actual the legal situation here? Because this was a political act out of necessity that President Obama felt he had to do. So could you deconstruct their legalistic arguments?
Yeah, so a couple of things on that. And the ironic thing, about Sessions' questioning of the legality of the program is that, you know, hours after Sessions talked on and on about how the program is unconstitutional, the president tweeted, if Congress doesn't get it, you know, doesn't enact DACA into law, I will revisit the issue, which makes you wonder if you thought this was an illegal act by President Obama to begin with, what are you revisiting, you know, if Congress can't do it? So to me, Sessions and Trump are trying to hide behind the courts. But the reality is the DACA is a program. It's actually been challenged before. Those challenges didn't go anywhere. The program that Sessions has talked about, DAPA, which is a 2014 program that is similar in some ways but different in others, was enjoined by a single district court judge in Brownsville, Texas, and it was upheld by the most conservative Supreme Court in the country. And in fact, four judges in that circuit court, in the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, heard the case, and two of them sided with the past administration, and two of them sided with the states that were challenging the program. So the idea that this is a program that's unconstitutional is absolutely ungrounded. And in fact, just last month, over 100 law professors wrote a letter to the president explicitly laying out the case for why DACA is, in fact, legal. So Attorney General Sessions said what he had to say in order to justify your decision. But, in our view, the legality of the program is absolutely clear. And not to mention the fact that this is not, I find it a bit laughable that this is a president that is talking about the Constitution. It's not a president who has, it's not like we have a president who's consistently acting in accordance of law. In fact, we saw with the Muslim ban, we saw how court after court has struck that down for being unconstitutional. We know that Sessions and Trump have talked about how sanctuary cities are lawless places that are in violation of the law. And again, court after court, just in the past few weeks, have dealt them losses and have shown that their statements were untrue. So both Sessions and Trump aren't credible sources when it comes to what's constitutional and what's not.
Well, let's just in the last couple of minutes, Kamal, let's have talk about the lawsuit filed by 14 states in the District of Columbia on Wednesday against President Trump's decision to roll back DACA, along with the Washington State, New York, and Connecticut, New Mexico, Illinois, Hawaii, North Carolina, Oregon, Rhode Island, Delaware, Iowa, Pennsylvania, Virginia, and Washington, D.C., all signed on. And it seems to be that the basis of this case is similar to the Muslim ban, which various courts and appeals courts are overturned as well, need to say drafted by the same person, Stephen Miller, that they were unconstitutional because they singled out targeted Muslims based on their national origin, and that the evidence was used by the judges, particularly here in the Ninth Circuit Court in California, was that all they had to do was go back to the campaign and have Trump talking about Muslims. The Muslims are coming. The Muslims are coming. Well, is that going to be the same argument here from these 14 states in the District of Columbia, that Trump has said all these terrible things about Latinos?
In part. And I think, these are all, relevant things that, we need to look at when we assess the motivation behind, the administration's decisions. And, that lawsuit, which relates to a lawsuit that we and some of our allies filed yesterday, challenging the elimination, the end of the program, are going to be part of the fight that we're going to put up on behalf of Dreamers whose lives have been, appended, by yesterday's cruel decision. But ultimately, the answer here is going to be in Congress. Ultimately, Congress is going to have to act and find, and find true stability for the 800,000 people who have DACA and their millions of family members. And there is bipartisan support in Congress for enacting something like the DREAM Act. Both Republicans and Democrats have openly expressed support for a law that protects streamers. And there is support among the general public for having Dreamers stay here, live here, continue to contribute, and ultimately get citizenship. And that support crosses the political spectrum. And it's there even among people who voted for Trump. So I think ultimately we're going to fight this battle on all fronts. We're going to fight it in the courts. We're going to fight it in public opinion. But ultimately, it's going to be Congress that's going to have to act and enact a permanent solution for this population.
And I think the Dreamers and their supporters are going to fight it in the streets, aren't they? Aren't there going to be a lot of demonstrations? There already have been a number.
Absolutely. And, we've already seen that in the last 24 hours, and I think that's only going to continue and get amplified over the next days, weeks, and months.
Well, Kamal Esaheb, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
All right. Thanks so much, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Kamal Esaheb, who's an immigration policy attorney at the National Immigration Law Center, who engages in advocacy and technical assistance relating to state and local enforcement of immigration law and access to legal status for immigrants. His advocacy has focused on the passage of the DREAM Act, implementation of the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals Program, and state and local enforcement of immigration law. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.